thought I'd talk to you today about what makes educational experiences memorable. It's always a problem for professors because we know that 99.9% of what we say to students is forgotten. But every now and again, something sticks. It's very hard to say why. Well, last week I had an interesting experience. Since COVID, I've started doing rather more local things, a bit more. And so I was asked by a group of elderly people in a nearby community who have a lecture every now and again and then English-type tea afterwards, rather civilised, whether I would talk to them. And I said, sure. And I thought I would talk about education in a very broad sense. Obviously, the first thing that I wanted to do was to get them on board with me, so to speak. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Could you tell me the names of your teachers in elementary school from 80 years ago, 70 years ago? And, of course, they all said, yes, of course. Yeah. They could remember. And immediately they were into reminiscence mode. And the fact is, of course, almost everybody can remember early teachers, particularly if they came from the old-fashioned system when the Miss Minnies of Wendell Berry's Watch With Me were the standard model of an infant school teacher, someone who loves the children and loves books and loves play and teaches by introducing the one to the other. Not what's happening anymore. Now teachers are making children feel uncomfortable in the first weeks of school by telling them they don't really know what gender they are, and then standing them in a row, say, are you more girl or more boy, as though you could choose. They're distinctly uncomfortable with this because it doesn't make any sense and it's not what they're about. So we were underway, and then I said, the world that you and I went to school in is a very different one from the world that your grandchildren or great-grandchildren, which is where I've got to now, they're not yet at school. Their world is going to be very, very different. The question is, can we be helpful to them? In what way are they different? And I said, well, they have a tacit world. We had a tacit world that they don't have. Now, that word tacit is a word that people don't use a lot, but it's a very useful word. Tacit means something that you know and you're quite sure about, but you never bother or don't need to explain. The best example of the word tacit that you can immediately relate to is if you have a hobby of any sort and then you go to some sort of exhibition of work done in the area that you're interested in. If I asked you half an hour later which are the best exhibits, you wouldn't have any difficulty in picking out the best ones. But if I then asked you, how do you know the best ones? Well, they say, well, I just know. I'm interested in these things. That's tacit knowledge. It's real knowledge. It's not made up. It's real. But you can't explain it properly in a way that the modern world thinks explanations should come. The modern world's wrong. Of course, we need both thoughts. The tacit world is necessary for the advancing world at the moment. Now, the easiest way in Canada to make this point is, you say, if you took somebody from Europe who hadn't been exposed to ice hockey, let's say we went in the heyday of Gretzky and he was playing, and you would point him out on the ice and say, he's the best player on the ice. They would say, why? Now, it would be very difficult to explain to somebody who had no feel for ice hockey why Gretzky was the best player. But if you were talking to a hockey aficionado, yeah, isn't it amazing? He seems to be in space at the right time, and he's always finding other people with the puck, etc., etc. But you took all that in very quickly. But to the outsider, it wasn't immediately apparent. The best example from my point of view as a Christian, for instance, is conversion is in exactly the same category. It's tacit knowledge. Now, we're often bullied by society into trying to give explanations in the terms that they want. We shouldn't do that. We should tell them as it actually is. When, by whatever means, God comes into your life, that's something you can't deny. It's also something that's extremely difficult to explain. And one thing to do is to say, well, this is difficult. I actually enjoy this when it happens in an academic setting and I meet someone who I haven't seen for a while, who I used to meet when I was an active academic. We were friends, so to speak, certainly more than just colleagues. And so after the lecture, they'll come up and say, "Huh, good to see you again. I haven't seen you for several years." I said, "No, I stopped doing science some years ago." And he said, "Yeah, I used to read your stuff until the mid-90s. The clear implication being that I lost my mind somewhere in the 90s. And so I said to him, "You think I've lost it?" He said, "Well, what you write's rubbish now, isn't it?" Very complimentary academics. I said, "Well, I think I can prove you're wrong about that." Look of surprise, I said, "Well, if somebody loses their mind, what happens to everything in their life?" "Well, it falls apart, doesn't it?" "Yeah. But when I started taking faith seriously, life didn't so much fall apart as fall together. So my faith is not, as you would like to believe, irrational, so much as supra-rational. It's not incompatible with rationality at all. But it's more than that. It's not accounted for by pure rationality as we know it in the Western world these days. It's Jesus talking to Nicodemus. You can't get to where you want to go from where you are now without something happening to you from outside. That's tacit knowledge. The world, I'll come back to that again a little bit further on in this discussion. But the world that we grew up in, people over the age of 80, say, had a tacit knowledge to it that we didn't even think about. Now, in Britain, for instance, after the Industrial Revolution, very few people in the working class went to church. So the street where I grew up, some 400-odd houses, I only know of three families that I could name who went to church regularly. None of the others went. But that world was informed by an understanding that came from the past. This is a blue-collar environment, working class, but we didn't lock the door. There were no attacks on women. Divorce was extremely rare. It's a different world from the world we're in today. If you live in Chicago at the weekend in a working-class black area, that's not going to be a description of what it's like at all, is it? There are a dozen murders most weekends. That's a very different world. So what's gone on? What happened? Well, in Britain, we kept the Ten Commandments in church, in school. We kept the Bible in school, not for religious reasons, but for cultural reasons. We had more sophisticated people in charge of education than we have now. Every society has to have some norms. You can't start from the ground up for everything. And so the cultural riches of a society come out of what they have done over time and become part of their character. Like the Germanic concern to have everything done neatly in order and on time, so to speak, that aspect of the German character is real. The flamboyance of the Italians. One builds the Mercedes, the other builds the Ferrari. They're different sorts of cars. So cultures do have an impact. I could put you in an aeroplane and fly you anywhere around the world, and you get off and you're not allowed to talk to anybody. You can just watch. You would work out whether you're in a Hindu society, a Buddhist society, a Marxist society, a post-Christian society, an Amish society, without asking any questions, because they have observable norms on the outside. So we loved our teachers when we were in infant school. We didn't have any sense that they were challenging our world. They were building our world. They were the Miss Minis. They loved children. They loved teaching. That's as it should be. I was so confident of what was going to happen that I insisted that my mother not take me to school on day one. I would go next door with the boy next door. He was 2 years older than me, and he went to the same school, so he could take me along. So first day of school, I went on my own. That was fine. Because it was a secure world, all sorts of things were predictable. Now, almost everything is up for grabs. So students in university are walking on eggshells because there's no tacit world of common behaviour that everybody accepts, there's a constant tension. This is not good. This is not a good learning environment. So our tacit worlds have got thinner and thinner and thinner. Those of you who are really interested in picking up on this idea, you would find the easiest start, I think, would be two little books, one by Leslie Newbegin called Foolishness to the Greeks, published by Erdmans, and the other, anyway, it's on my website on the book list, but she had dinner with Michael Polanyi, who brought the idea of tacit knowledge into the Western speech some 50 or more years ago, and she describes his way of thought. It's interesting that, as far as I can find out, he was an unbelieving secular Jew in Hungary who was smart enough to be corresponding with Einstein in the 1930s. And then in 1917, of course, the Russian Revolution had occurred, and he realized if it worked, it was going to swallow Hungary. He just about got out in time, ended up in Manchester, where he began to give up on chemistry and start thinking about the philosophy of science. And tacit knowledge is one of his real contributions, because when he got to Manchester, he became very interested in working-class people, what they did. And most working-class men in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, there were smart men who were under-challenged in their work. They were very good craftsmen. When they came home, they'd have supper, and then they'd go down the shed at the bottom of the garden, make things. And Polanyi was interested in what they made. One of the interesting examples was he found a man who was making very good violins. They were so good they were being bought by the members of the Halle Orchestra. It provides perhaps the best example I know of what tacit knowledge is. So if you wanted to be a violin maker and you found this guy, he'd say, well, show me some of your work. And in most cases, he'd say, no, you don't have what it takes. I don't want you to waste your time. You will never be a great violin maker. Just by looking at your work, you could see that. On occasionally, you might say, well, you have some talent. Let's see how you do. You can come and watch and make a coffee, and eventually, after a few exercises, so to speak, you can be given a piece of valuable alpine pine to cut out, and then he'd say, give it to me, and he'd feel it and say, you could take a bit more off there. That's okay. Or, I'm afraid this won't be a great violin. You've taken a bit too much off here. He can feel something that he can't explain. We know that he can do it because he makes violins that great players of violins like. That's tacit knowledge, knowing when you've accomplished something and done it well. You can take that idea in all sorts of directions. I mean, a recipe taken down from YouTube doesn't mean that you're going to make the thing the person's making, does it? A recipe is a reduced account of what goes into making something. A great chef is going to make a lot more than can be put into the recipe. There's all sorts of things going in, texture, etc., etc., subtle tastes, whatever. That's not in the recipe book. There's attempts at it, but you will never be a signature chef on that basis. That's got to come from deep within, so to speak. And we have cut out that bit of our world in education to a much greater degree than we should have. And that's making it an impoverished education system. So let's move on a little bit. When I went to high school, I met a level of excellence that I'd never met before. A master who spoke five languages. And all the boys in, well, not all, probably 90% of the boys in my final year at high school ended up as academics, professors. So going to medical school was, by comparison, less demanding than high school was, which is unusual, but that's the way it was. Now, of course, we've got far too many people going to university, so the whole thing has been downgraded. The sooner we cut back to 5 or 6% academics, the better, because academics can do dangerous things when they don't have an outlet that challenges them sufficiently. Then they start causing trouble, which is what things like CRT and all the rest are, the products of minds inadequately engaged with reality. So medicine, by comparison, was somewhat boring. I was never going to be an orthopaedic surgeon. I knew that, so I didn't do any orthopaedics. I learnt that from the book. And so on. Went through medicine, did the necessary year after graduation, and enjoyed it. I was about to go sailing around the world as a ship's doctor. I was about to sign up when my first boss, physician, saw me in the corridor and said, well, what are you doing next, John? And I said, well, I'm going to take a break and go around the world. He said, no, you can't do that. That would be a waste. You should. There's a job at Oxford. You should apply. You'll get it. In neurology. And in those days, that sort of patriarchal behaviour was part of the deal. You didn't say no to people like that. And thank God I didn't. He also said, make sure the woman you marries can argue with you. I did that too. That was a wise piece of advice. So I went the academic route. We got married about 2 years into my career. I shouldn't have got married, but we did. My wife was the one who made the mistake, not me. I went to my wedding service not knowing there was going to be a sermon. And the sermon was directed entirely at me, and the text was, no man setting out to build a tower doesn't first find out whether he's got enough bricks. Rector was looking at me saying, I don't think you've got enough bricks for this marriage project. And I was at least smart enough to realise he was right. So that's when I started looking for help, and that was good. So we were both going to have careers, but we were careless, and shortly we had 3 children. And fortunately, Sally loved the little brats, and so it worked out okay, except that it was a lot of work. And she said, you go out before the children are awake and come back when they're asleep too often. Can't you do something else for a bit? So in Britain, you don't get a permanent academic job until you're 30, so I could fill in 5 years. I'd got all the exams out of the way to do some research. And that turned out to be quite interesting. It worked out well. So when it came to an end, Sally's next prod was to say, well, I like this life better than the one we had before. Can't you do something useful with the results of your PhD in a nice place, preferably warm? And we ended up in Jamaica with a Wellcome Trust fellowship, which was wonderful, studying the difference between kwashiorkor and marasmus and looking at the treatment of severe malnutrition. I thought I could spare 2 years. In the end, we spared 7 and were privileged to be part of a little group of docs and PhD guys who actually solved the problem of what to do with a 10-pound two-year-old to bring it back to normal. Turned out to be very counterintuitive. So it's only in the last year or so that it's appeared in an American textbook. It was published in 1979. That shows how long it can take to get a counterintuitive idea across, even when it's right. But it's getting there now. But other things came along at this point. When that was over, I was supposed to go back to a job in London, but fortunately Mrs. Thatcher cancelled the funding, and so I didn't have a job. The trust was embarrassed, but didn't need to bother. I had 2 offers, one in Harvard and one in Ottawa, and I took the one in Ottawa. We went to Harvard first, and because I knew the dean, we worked on the same protein. That's why I was invited. And in 1980, very few physicians knew anything about nutrition, but I'd spent 7 years growing new bodies at 25 times or so the normal rate for age, so I knew a bit about nutrition. So he'd just taken over as dean, and he wanted to improve that aspect of the program and asked me to come and look at setting up a program. It only took 24 hours for me to realize I couldn't work in Harvard because the atmosphere's horrendous. People writing their results in code. That's not good news. What happened to collegiality? Well, Claudine Gay has just showed us what's happened to collegiality. It's gone. Within 24 hours, I said, Dan, I can't work here. He said, I'm sorry you found that out so quickly. I hoped you wouldn't. But you're right. I'm trying to do something about it. And you're right to go off to Ottawa with your 4 children because you'll be fine there. And Ottawa was wonderful for us. So we settled down in Ottawa, and I had to teach for the first time in the university for 7 years, and things had changed. I never had a handout at any stage during my training. They were non-existent. Nobody handed handouts out. So I gave my first lecture in Ottawa with no handout. And half the students revolted, and the other half wanted more. I had to bend, of course, as I began to realize that I was way out of touch. I didn't take any interest in teaching. I thought, this is useless, a waste of time. Teaching biochemistry to medical students is useless anyway for most of them because they won't forget. They won't remember any of it. This is part of an educational process. It has no permanent mark on your career. Surely we could save money there. We only need a few physicians who actually understand biochemistry because they need to understand it properly, and that's a lot of work. It's like learning a new language, but we don't do that. We pretend that your doctor has biochemical knowledge. Well, he might remember the Krebs cycle if you're lucky, but if you don't have a Krebs cycle, you're dead, so knowing about the Krebs cycle has no practical application in any simple way. So I didn't take much interest in the students, even in my honours biochemistry course on reading the literature. I didn't learn the names of 20 students. I always got the class down to 20 because I didn't want to mark more than 20 scripts. The turning point came a little later when I'd become good friends with a philosopher and we started having lunch together regularly. And one of us, we still argue about who it was, discovered 4 lines from the 12th century. Some seek knowledge for the sake of knowledge, that is curiosity. Well, we've both done that. Others seek knowledge in order that they themselves may be known. From that is vanity, and from that day onwards, I call my curriculum vitae, my curriculum vanitas, because that's where it is. The average scientific paper is read by 6 people, including the referees. It's not about knowledge, it's about careers. The Claudine Gay episode showed they didn't even bother to look at her CV. They certainly didn't read it with any care, because if they had, she would never have got the job. 11 publications, largely plagiarized, do not a head of Harvard make, but they missed that. It's one of the many terrifying things that popped up. So he goes on, this is Bernard of Clairvaux writing, he says, there are others who seek knowledge in order to sell it, that is dishonorable. You could argue about that one. Where does capitalism fit in? Where does Marxism fit in? That's another issue altogether. But it was the last one that really killed me. There are some who seek knowledge in order to edify others, to build up others, and that is love. And I was not guilty. I felt guilty. Said so to my wife. She said, well, why don't you bring your students home to supper? I said, would you feed them? She said, of course. And we had a nice meal, and then we started talking, and they didn't leave till midnight. And I realized there was this huge metaphysical hole. They had no metaphysics in their life at all. All the big questions they had no answers for, although they were going into medicine, where they were going to face death, suffering, and apparent injustice. So if you have no basis for dealing with those topics, you're in trouble, and it shows. I mean, doctors have a higher suicide rate than Aboriginal population. That's telling you about the stresses of being a doctor in a very quantitative way, and it's not getting any better. And we still don't do anything about it in any realistic way, because what answers are there to death, suffering, and injustice that don't involve transcendence? None, as far as I'm concerned. That's the issue that's at stake. So that really shocked me. A change was underway. The next thing that happened was that I got carted off to Africa, again, my wife, because we went to a little church. She brought some missionaries home. They found out what I knew about malnutrition, said, we've got a huge problem, come and help us. Under my breath, no. Publicly, well, in principle, yes. And I was due a sabbatical. My family thought Africa sounded wonderful. And we had I had a family war that I lost, and we went. Sometime I'll tell you the story of that, because you couldn't write it as fiction. But I knew that the work that we'd done in Jamaica was not translating into diminished malnutrition prevalence rates and mortality rates in any dramatic way, as it should have done. So I wanted to go and find out why. And this is the next thing about education. I set up a program and used my children as the workers, because I knew they would do exactly what I told them to do, which they did. And we could resuscitate malnourished children in a mud hut to prove that it was possible, not at the rates we achieved in Jamaica, about half that rate, but still very creditable rates. My kids loved it. It was good for them. They had a view of the world which other young people of their age didn't have. Two of them didn't finish high school. They did it by correspondence because a bad hair day really didn't seem worth the fuss that it had created in most of their contemporaries. And they all went off to university and they'd done well. And they're all envious of the oldest one, who's actually with us at the moment with a husband who's been picking up abandoned children in Malawi for 20 years, a place that's currently facing a 50% per annum inflation rate and starvation, and of course not even making the news. So we set up. I trained some Africans to identify malnourished children early in the process when it's easy to treat them, and went back to Canada for a while. Came back a year later, and I could already demonstrate that the program was not working. The next bit of education. Why? These were people who were nurses, who had some education. They were certainly not unintelligent. What was going on? One of those nurses had his own child die of malnutrition. I asked him why. He told me that he was going to lie by looking at the ground and not at me, and he said, well, we didn't feed them properly. But I knew that wasn't the truth. That wasn't what he believed. So I sent my supervisor, Karume, go and find out what he really believes. He was back in a few minutes. He believed that an evil spirit had taken away the child's appetite. So he had spent his money on the witch doctor, which is a perfectly rational thing to do. If you believe, as they do, that disease is the consequence of random malicious activity by evil spirits. They have a belief in a distant God, but he doesn't really believe in us. But they don't. You can't stand in the middle of a rainforest and say this is chaos. It's not. It's anything but. So they believe in a distant creator of some sort, but it doesn't explain their lives, where as much as half their family may die out before maturity, their crops fail apparently at random, disease breaks out, they have the worst governments in the world. Not much evidence of a God of love there, and yet the church is growing in Africa in a way that it's not growing elsewhere. Why? Well, that's another story. So what was going on? You see, that everybody, whether they like it or not, has to have some sort of fallback position to explain the big questions of beginnings and meanings and purpose and death and suffering and justice and knowledge. If you don't have a story that gives you some basic foundation stones there, you're starting from the ground up. You know, it's too big a task, and so you get very neurotic, like all modern students are neurotic, because all the foundation stones have been pulled out. The Ten Commandments were those foundation stones, and they're not bad. You can rewrite them, and you can see that a society that says, okay, we'll agree to these for whatever reason, is going to have a degree of stability. It's going to survive. That's why the Jews survive. They have the best story for survival, for flourishing. That's why they win half the hard Nobel Prizes every year. The animistic one deals with the horrible apparent randomness of living in Central Africa, the chaos, the unpredictability of life, because evil spirits are local. So they explain why a child dies in one hut and not in the next one, and so on and so forth. So animism, which, as Chesterton points out, is the biggest story in the world that informed most society for a long, long while, does answer the big questions, whereas our modern CRT-type rubbish, for instance, doesn't answer any of the big questions well. It's in denial of the answers we do have. So that's the problem that we face. So I didn't know what to do. I wasn't doing what my wife wanted me to do, which was to save lives. And I said, I'm not here to do pediatrics primarily. I'm happy to help, but if I could work out why malnutrition happens in this society and do something about that, that would make a huge impact, because it's a major factor in almost all the premature deaths of children in Africa. So it's much more important than individual cases overall. And then brilliantly, she said, well, at least you could do a Bible study with the graduates of university in a village who are not working. So you send someone off to a university on the other side of the country, and they get a degree from a university that's still finding its way, that's not going to be that great. They do it because they have superb memories. I mean, the average African can speak three languages for a start. They have very good memories, and you can get through the modern university course, which has to be understandable by bureaucrats. You check the boxes to get your degree. There's no question of whether you're learning anything there. They don't even attempt to answer that question. Sort of thing you can walk through if you've got a good memory and you're a little cynical. So they come back with a degree and a desire for a white-collar job, which doesn't exist. So a couple of them were helping in the pharmacy at the Mission Hospital, learning a little bit doing that, but not what they hoped for. They claimed to be Christian. So I said, why don't you do a Bible study with them? Do Deuteronomy. I think they'll find it interesting. That was a wise choice, so I did. We started doing it in three languages, slowly, and then a miracle occurred. A translator walked 1,000 kilometres to get to me, who could go from the tribal language to English. Not long after that, I ended up teaching about 6,000 people out of doors one afternoon, Deuteronomy 4, 5 and 6, Why the Jews Succeed. Astonishingly, the day afterwards, at the end of the talk, I said, look, I'm your older brother in the faith, so I can tell you, I know that you men don't eat with your children. You eat first, and then you leave the women and children to clean up the pot. You've got to change that. You've got to feed with your children, because then you will see who needs help and who doesn't. The next day, our driver said to Sally, I went home, I didn't feed with the children, but I didn't feed first. And I noticed that one of my children was a slow eater, so I gave him his own plate. That's malnutrition gone in that family. In one afternoon of the exposition of Deuteronomy 4, 5 and 6, did more than 30 years of nutrition education programs, which were not premised on a cultural reality. Just like education is no longer premised on cultural foundations that are solid. So not surprisingly, we're having all the problems we have. So that was a moment of truth for me, and I'm still working my way out along the way. It also made me look back at other things. One way of thinking about it is all the little things that were important that I only realized years later were important. The fact that all my infant school teachers loved children and loved books and encouraged, and they didn't have set standards. They individualized so that smart kids were pushed off on one side and given extra books to read and were jumped up a couple of years. And we're not constantly looking over the shoulder and saying, how will other kids feel about this? Because the other kids didn't feel about it anyway. They were all in the same process of learning or not, as the case may be. But to have those kinds of teachers and then to go to high school and see somebody who really enjoyed learning but couldn't even afford a car, it gave me different standards, different ideas. Then to have the patriarchal care of my career by a senior physician who in the modern world wouldn't dare to say anything like that, that what he did was good, right and helpful. These are things that we don't think about. Well, the next one that I hadn't thought about and should have done, shortly after I'd started my PhD, a few months into it, I got meningitis, and so I was off work for a while. Not a great experience, no results, and enforced nothingness for a while I recovered from meningitis. Of course, it's time to think. In the end, it was very profitable, but the real reason for it happening was other than that. We lived in a little block of apartments, six apartments in Blackheath in London, and our neighbour, who was a Reuters correspondent, said, going off to the Middle East for a year or so. So he rented his apartment. And a young man moved in with his wife and two children. I was in the garden when he arrived. Can I help you move in? He said, no, I don't need any help. And it was obvious to me very quickly that this guy did everything for himself. He didn't need help from anyone. He was that kind of guy. Like me, from a blue-collar background, I discovered later. But the difference was that my dad did everything he could to get me the best education he could, whereas David's dad didn't. So age 15, he was shipped off to Rolls-Royce as an apprentice electrician. He was much more than that. At least Rolls were a good enough company to realise this kid's smart. And his math master at school said, David, go to night school, you can get a degree. So it wasn't long before he got a degree from the University of London externally in less than 4 years. And he worked his way up from being just an electrician to a technician. He was running the heat flux analysis section of nuclear engines, Rolls-Royce. And Americans would come around and look at what Rolls is doing in terms of producing very small nuclear engines for the future. They know it's the only way for the future, the green. Only people who can't count think that green approaches can work. Nuclear is going to be the backbone. We have no other option in sight. The so-called renewables are so unreliable as to be virtually useless most of the time. Dr. Dawson, this is impressive work. He would say, Mr. Dawson. He was an inverted snob. He only had an undergraduate degree. And Rolls, of course, were embarrassed. They said, look, we'll pay for you to get a PhD. And he said, well, the hell do I need a PhD for? I have to teach those guys what to do. And he wouldn't. He knew they weren't going to fire him. He got two kids. He'd built his house in the country. He was fine. But they said, well, you could do an MSc at the Naval College. That could be done in a year. It would look better. And he thought, well, a year in London, my kids were sort of 7, 8 sort of age. They'd enjoy London. There's lots to see and do. So he said, all right, I'll do that. And he moved in just as I was off work for 3 months. And we got to know one another. He would come back from the college in the middle of the afternoon because he could have taught the course himself. Needed in any way, and we started playing chess, and we started talking, getting to know one another, and learning one another's stories. And then one day we were playing chess, and I got a terrible headache. I can't even see the board properly. I have to go in and lie down. He said, fine, I'll bring the chess set in. And the next day, when he came back from the college, he said, you have any more books like the one you were reading yesterday? I said, well, that's where he went. Now, David Dawson is the only man I've ever met who became a Christian in 24 hours by reading a commentary on the book of Habakkuk, which most of you listening to me couldn't even find in the Bible. But it's about somebody who is being told by God what terrible things are going to happen to Israel. And he says, you can't do this. God says, I'm God, just you watch. And David, everything he did was turning to gold, but he wasn't happy. He didn't know why. Habakkuk began to show him a dimension that he'd missed out completely. So I said, oh, why don't you read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity? So I gave him that. I did nothing. I gave him one book I left lying on the grass and one book I gave him. And 2 days later, he said, can I come to church with you? He'd changed his whole orientation. When he got back to Derby at the end of that year, he said, it was as though I had got new eyes. And I lived in a village, and some of the teenagers were getting up to minor acts of vandalism. But then I looked around, as I'd never done before, and realized nobody cared about them. There was no youth group, nothing for them to do. So he joined the church and started a youth group. The vandalism stopped. He got back to Rolls and his unit, and he said, I didn't know anything about the people I worked with. I just cared about their output. So I changed that and started to care about them. He ended up, before he died prematurely, as director for personnel for the whole of Rolls-Royce and head of the committee that renewed the middle of Derby of the last of the World War II damage. Once flew all the way to Jamaica to change the rear bearings on myself. A world that cannot explain those events is an incomplete world. That's all I would say. And an education system that denies the history we've had, that can't bear to tell the truth about the fact that Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Boyle, Faraday, Clark, Maxwell, Eddington were all Christian. It's not to be dismissed easily. It can be. In fact, if you go to conferences on the history of science, the honest discussions that go on over dinner will contain something like this. Yes, the church was not a perfect patron of science, but we have to admit it was the only patron of science. Didn't happen anywhere else. By didn't happen, I mean experimental science, collecting data, analysing it in the astronomical sense, but didn't happen anywhere else. The classicists like to think that Aristotle did science well. He set up a lot of things for it, particularly logic, but his physics was entirely wrong. His biology was observational. It was good. No experiments. He didn't trust inductive reasoning, whereas Clerk Maxwell talked straightforwardly about inductive reasoning. They talk about hypothetical deductive now because they want to avoid induction. Why? Because you can only trust induction if you believe that under the surface chaos of life, there's order. And the only reason you can believe that is because you believe there's a creator who is rational. Allah is not bound by human rationality. Jews and Christians say humans are bound by rationality at one level because it's God's rational. That makes sense. It's not stupid. So all these things were going on, and I've already run out of the time for this particular talk, but I want to finish one other thing happened at about the time that these things were falling into place in Canada, which was some years after David. One day, through the internal mail, there was a missive from our Faculty of Education, basically saying that teaching in a modern university should be from a morally neutral position. I was so angry, steam was rising, and I sat down at my computer and I wrote a little paper in about 3 hours. Shut the door, took the phone off the hook and just wrote. And it was done, only a dozen pages or so. And it was called The Myth of Moral Neutrality because moral neutrality doesn't exist. Whenever you have to decide between two things that are of a moral nature, you can't have a morally neutral system. All that they were saying is, instead of having your rich Judeo-Christian heritage in which morality was taught by narrative, which we've been talking about forever, Christ amazingly didn't. He wasn't didactic like the ones that are trying to run the university at the moment and trying to control speech and everything else. No, he would talk to people because he liked them. And then they would ask him a question and he would say, that's a good question. Let me tell you a story. And then he'd say, now you go and work it out. Serious Christians could probably sit down at a table and write down pretty well every parable and miracle that Christ ever said or did. And they couldn't write anything from their first year courses at university pretty well. The odd little bit here and there. So why is it a man who never wrote anything down permanently has contributed the basic structure to the whole of Western civilization? He changed the history of the world in the early centuries of Christian era. Common era, as they like to say now, but it's not. He knew what he was doing. Why don't we take more notice? When you look at narrative and think about it well, you end up writing great stories. Now, the modern psychological novel, you read it once and toss it in the garbage. But as Chesterton points out, the good stories, the big ones with a long history, fairy stories, Bible stories, they stick. And that kind of narrative that implies that there is something underneath. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is classic. What's really classic about that, of course, is that Edward Arnold sent the manuscript out to his standard readers and they all trashed it. Fortunately, he asked his son, who was early teens, to read it. He said, Dad, this is the best story I've ever read. And so he published it, and he got a winner because he knew that the boy was right. And, of course, my favourite line from The Lord of the Rings is not in the film because the film is made by Jackson, who is totally controlled by the modern narrative. My favourite scene is at the end of the long chase across the plains of Rohan. Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas in the grass, and then they see these horsemen coming up with spears. They end up around circling them because these are bad times. They could have killed them. Nobody would have said anything, but Aoma was a good man, as we are to find out. He didn't kill him. And then Aragorn stands up and says, good and evil are not one thing amongst men and another amongst dwarves and elves. And it is a man's part to discern them. Aoma makes the right choice. There's a key moment in the story where Tolkien puts it on the line. What you understand good and evil to be is what divides us. And Solzhenitsyn in his Harvard address a few years ago. Good and evil is a line that goes down the heart of every man. It's in the middle of us, and we're in denial at the moment, and we need to change that. So those little events along the way are the most important things in education, the things you remember, the things that change you and your character. Now, I've missed other things out. It takes longer than I thought. Thank you, guys, for those of you who occasionally write to me. I'd like to see some more. Thanks.